Breakthrough.
You are now listening to Breakthrough News. It's 5 p.m. You're listening to Breakthrough News, and this is The Punch Out. We're following the news all day so you don't have to, giving you everything you need to know about what's in the headlines and what should be. And yes, we are back with you here on the 12th of April, 2021. Very happy to be with you as we start the week here. We're going to be talking about the possibility of U.S. combat troops leaving Iraq and when that may be. We're also going to be discussing the elections in Ecuador and Peru briefly. We're going to talk much more about that on our patrons-only podcast coming up this Wednesday. So go to patreon.com/breakthroughnews if you want access to that. But before we turn to either of those two very important issues, we are going to turn to yet another police killing in the Minneapolis area, this one yesterday.
Was 20 years old. He got pulled over for having air fresheners in the car that I just gave him.
2 weeks ago.
All he did was have air fresheners in the car and they told him to get out of the car. He got out of the car and his girlfriend said they shot him. He got back in the car and he drove away and crashed. And now he's dead on the ground since 1:47.
That was the mother of Dante Wright, 20 years old, murdered by police officers in Brooklyn Center, Minnesota yesterday, just outside of Minneapolis. Protests of hundreds of people erupted, lasting into Sunday night, at times including a back and forth between the police using chemical agents, rubber bullets to suppress protests, and garbage and projectiles allegedly being thrown back at them. The National Guard was mobilized at one point, and it appears in other parts of Brooklyn Center, people took out their anger on some businesses. The killing of Wright struck a raw nerve in the suburb of Minneapolis as it comes in the midst of the trial of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd, of course, in the same metropolitan area. While police have been at pains in this trial to stress Chauvin's actions were unique, as we heard from Breakthrough News when we were on the ground in Minneapolis, police brutality is endemic to the broader region. And indeed, 21-year-old Kobe Heisler, an unarmed autistic man, was murdered by Brooklyn Center police in the fall of 2019. And by the way, we spoke with Kobe's mother and mothers of other victims of police brutality in the Minneapolis episode, in the Minneapolis area, I should say, on the March 11th edition of The Freedom Side on Breakthrough News. You can see that at youtube.com/breakthroughnews, March 11th. The circumstances of Wright's murder yesterday were, like so many, a murder that began with a traffic stop. Police pulled Wright and his girlfriend over for some sort of traffic violation. His mother stated it was because there was an air freshener hanging from the rearview mirror. He had called her to get the insurance information for the car that his family had recently bought him. That's how she knew that. He was saying this is what he thought it was for. Police claimed that they found he had some sort of warrant and that when they tried to detain him, he stepped back in the car. And then for stepping back in the car, they then shot and killed him. There was, of course, a witness, and police say they believe the officer had a body camera, so likely in coming days, we will learn much more about what happened. But there are some basic things that are clear right now. The first being, police violence is systemic, not personal, and just putting in jail this or that bad actor cannot arrest the overall phenomenon. Second, the traffic stops are often the beginning of these stories is notable and based on the clear bias, most of it racial, that exists in policing. Because, of course, anytime someone is stopped, it's presented by police as some hugely dangerous potential situation where they have to be on guard and ready to kill. But in fact, the most comprehensive study done of this issue to date, whether or not the police should be scared when they stop people in cars, and it was done in 2019, noted that, quote, violence against officers was rare. And incidents that do involve violence are typically low risk and do not involve weapons. Under a conservative estimate, the rate for a felonious killing of an officer during a routine traffic stop was only 1 in every 6.5 million stops. The rate for an assault resulting in serious injury to an officer was only 1 in every 361,111 stops. In other words, The biggest issue here is racial bias of police, assuming people are dangerous and because of who they are, not because of anything that's going on, and going into these encounters with the shoot-to-kill sort of mentality based, again, not on evidence, but on stereotypes. Brooklyn Center has closed schools and imposed a curfew to try to tamp down protest over this latest police killing. Remains to be seen if that will be effective. But Brooklyn Center cops have demonstrated once again that, yes, it's more than a few bad apples. In Ecuador and Peru, voters defied pollsters as the right-wing businessman Guillermo Lasso was victorious in the second round of Ecuador's election and will become president. And the left-leaning teachers union leader Pedro Castillo appears to have won the first round of the Peruvian elections based on the results that are in now, giving him a chance to become president after a second round. Now, there's much to say here, quite a bit, in fact. And again, we're going to be discussing it more on Wednesday on our patrons-only episode of The Punch Out. Go to patreon.com/breakthroughnews and become a patron to get access to that. But there are a few points that we can make here, starting with Ecuador. Clearly, the main issue is that the left-leaning candidate Andres Arauz was unable to consolidate enough support in the second round. Some of this because other parties in the first round were, of course, right-wing, and thus their supporters naturally went to Lasso. But further and more importantly, there were splits among the popular classes that seemed to have made a big dent in his ability to win. Arauz, that is. The center of gravity, so to speak, of popular working class struggles in Ecuador comes heavily out of the indigenous and black communities. However, organizations representing these currents are not unitary, and some are divided amongst themselves. Most notably, this is the case with CONAIE, the nation's largest indigenous organization. CONAIE's president and currents within it came out for Arauz, saying the right-wing program of Lasso was unacceptable. Other significant sections, seemingly the majority current, advocated for a null vote to express dissatisfaction from both sides, with their opposition to Arauz being rooted in differences that really can be placed at the confluence of mining and indigenous land rights and how some of that had played out in the past in the former government that Arauz was a member of. Further, Yaku Perez, who is the candidate of CONAIE's political wing in the first round, is in an unscrupulous, unholy alliance with U.S. imperialism, cynically using various left-wing causes and ideas to swing votes behind the right-wing candidate and away from Arauz, which clearly had a significant effect in powering Lasso to victory. Peru saw a surprise in the opposite direction. As Pedro Castillo and his Peru Libre party appeared to come out of nowhere, they'd been polling outside of the top five candidates. Castillo's victory seems due to a range of factors, more than we can address here, but functionally seems to be a combination of A, his record outside of politics as a leader of mass teacher strikes in 2017, something which made him stand out from the politicians in Peru's very unpopular political class that made up most of the rest of the candidates, and that B, that same political class downplayed the working class and peasant forces and the role they could play, but Castillo seems to have rallied and relied on them to take first place here. Castillo is a strong supporter of the Chavista movement in Venezuela and the broader left-wing governments in Latin America. He advocates for something they call a people's economy with markets, where the state would have a strong role and industries like gas and mining would be subject to state ownership. He's also calling for a constituent assembly to rewrite the constitution that dates back to the reign of former dictator Alberto Fujimori, whose daughter Keiko, by the way, appears to have taken second based on the results currently in. And so that looks like the second round will be Fujimori versus Castillo. And the second round is likely to see vicious red baiting of Castillo. There was already some in the first round. And one major issue will be if he can consolidate other left-wing support. Veronica Mendoza also ran on a left-wing platform in the first round with many similar ideas and many left-wing parties supporting her. What happens with that vote will make a big difference for Castillo. And there are some differences, though, for sure, between the two camps, mainly on abortion and LGBTQ issues, but also among others. Most of the other candidates will likely favor anyone but Castillo. The issue of blank ballots and right-wing block voting will play a major role as well. Also, elections leave a fairly fractured Congress, which means whoever wins the second round may have difficulty governing. And Peru's political class in general has just been absolutely rocked by corruption scandals and huge protests over the last year or so. I mean, more people told pollsters they preferred none of the candidates over any individual candidate in the lead up. And Castillo himself may struggle to end up with more than 20% of the vote in the first round. So this may not be an end to the political turmoil in Peru, even though it's the end of the first round of the elections. So much more to be said here. Again, Wednesday, go to patreon.com/breakthroughnews, become a patron. You'll get access to our patrons-only version of this podcast. We'll be talking about this. But we can say for sure, certainly mixed results in Latin America as it concerns the growth of left-wing forces on the continent. While all the focus has been on U.S.-Iran semi-negotiations, U.S. officials have quietly also been meeting with the Iraqi government over the future of U.S. forces there. Iraqi officials have stated that the U.S. has agreed to a phased withdrawal of all combat troops. However, no timeline has been agreed upon. U.S. forces left Iraq, you may remember, in 2010, combat forces at least, because they could not come to terms on a status of forces agreement. U.S. troops were invited back in 2014 to battle ISIS. However, with that fight more or less having wound down, many Iraqis want the U.S. out. In fact, last year, the Iraqi parliament voted to expel all U.S. troops. The U.S., of course, does not want to leave for many reasons, but principally they view U.S. combat troops as a hedge or a bulwark against Iranian influence inside of Iraq and also blocking the ability for there to be closer relations between Iran, Syria, and Hezbollah by blocking various land routes between those countries that run through Iraq. Which is why the timing of the announcement of the phased withdrawal by the Iraqis is interesting. At the same time, the Iraqi government and the U.S. are talking. Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi has been cracking down on Iraqi groups that were part of the anti-ISIS fight affiliated with the popular mobilization units that are said to be affiliated with Iran and who harshly criticized the U.S. presence in the country. In particular, the government's been replacing hundreds of officers at borders and ports that were deemed to be too close to Iran and affiliated with these so-called pro-Iran factions. And those are very strategic positions. So to be replaced there is a big deal. And that leaves one to wonder if there is something of a quid pro quo here, that either the prime minister is A, using the withdrawal of U.S. troops, which is popular, as a lever against his own political opponents, i.e., I can get them to leave, but only if you guys do what I say. Or B is using a crackdown on pro-Iranian forces as a chip to motivate the U.S. to leave the country because it's popular. I want you to leave. We need you to leave. It's politically untenable, but, you know, you don't want to leave. But look, we're going to control these people who you hate. So you can leave and not worry about it. You can rely on us. Either way, the notable thing about this is that over a year after the Iraqi parliament voted in an admittedly non-binding resolution to expel U.S. troops, not only have they not left, but they actually won't leave. Iraq has to negotiate them leaving. In other words, negotiate their own sovereignty. The very fact that there are talks show that the Iraqi government recognizes it's politically untenable to keep the U.S. troops there. So again, why can't they just name the terms and say take it or leave it? If anything else shows you the semi-colonial reality imposed on Iraq by the U.S. occupation, this appears to be it. And that's going to do it for us here today on The Punch Out. We're going to be back with you tomorrow, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, as we always are. And don't forget, Wednesday, we have an extra edition of The Punch Out going in depth on a lot of things. This week, it's going to be Peru, Ecuador, Latin America more generally. Go to patreon.com/breakthroughnews, become a patron. You'll have access to that. We will see you here on The Punch Out tomorrow, 5 p.m. Eastern, on Breakthrough News.